Good morning. It's 39 minutes after the hour. Dr. Paul Kengor is from the Center for Vision and Values, Grove City College. And he's written a number of books. He's got a new one coming out we're going to talk about before the interview ends. Paul, good morning.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. Okay, last year, socialism, according to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, was the most looked-up word.
Yeah, you believe that?
I can't.
I mean, that is... I think it reflects a number of things too, Bill. One, you know, the fact that there's about 13 million people in the Democratic primary voted for a lifetime self-avowed socialist in Bernie Sanders, right? And you know, he considers himself, and he'll use words like democratic socialist, democratic socialism, and so forth. But that is really an astonishing number. I mean, Hillary Clinton got 17 million votes, so he wasn't far behind her. And Donald Trump got 14 million in the Republican primary, and that was a record for a Republican. So 13 million people voted for a socialist, and there are, you know, greater and greater numbers of people. In fact, one study shows that about, I think it's millennials, people first-time voters ages 18 to 25, 49% had a positive view of socialism compared to 43% that had a positive view of capitalism. So it's actually a higher positive view of socialism than capitalism here in this greatest capitalist country in the face of the earth. And so I think that's led to a lot of people literally going to their search engines to try to figure out, well, you know, what the heck does socialism even mean? And so you see that reflected in Merriam-Webster.
Let me get my jaw off the counter here from that little statistic.
Right, right.
And you recently have written an article about how socialism attacks the family, and you say, just as its inventors intended. Please say more about that.
Well, that's right. And this goes back to, you know, early founders of socialism slash communism, Marx and Engels, where they wrote that socialism is a transition step to full communism. 1848 Communist Manifesto, they wrote of the abolition of the family. They used those exact words. They actually finished
Really?
It with an exclamation mark.
Wow.
The original text says, abolition of the family, exclamation mark. And then it says, even the most radical flare up at this infamous proposal of the communists. And think about that in 1848, when they're writing the Communist Manifesto, they could already say then that the notion of abolishing the family is already an infamous proposal of the communists. So it's been around for a while, already in 1848 with the founding document of communism. So they Marx and Engels, one of their most famous works, actually was published a year after Marx's death, 1884, was on the origins of the family. So these two were messing with the family and looking to try to take down the sort of traditional biblical family from the very beginning. This is a long march that goes back to at least the early to mid-19th century.
Paul, now, you talk about in this article that you say socialism is ineffective, unproductive, and impoverishing. It creates not economic prosperity, but backwardness and often genuine deprivation. We see what's going on in Venezuela, for example. What a great example.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I mean, really, and that is one way in which it hurts the family. I mean, if above all you have impoverished families where you have mom and dad who can't provide for the kids, who can't put a roof over their heads, or at least can't feed them properly, can't raise them properly, can't save money for them. I mean, that in a way would be how socialism, you know, directly or indirectly via its economic failures hurts the family. So yeah, that's really important for people to understand right there. That should be kind of an obvious way that socialism hurts the family. But beyond that, the sort of general, more philosophical way that it hurts the family, we had, even here in America in the early 1800s, transplanted to this country people like Robert Owen, the British socialist. And this will shock people. I mean, you just said, Bill, about lifting your jaw up off the floor. Wait till people hear this one. This was 20-some years before the Communist Manifesto was published. It was July 4th, 1826. Now, that was a special date in America. It was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. In fact, on that date, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, the geniuses behind the Declaration, both died on July 4th, 1826. But on that date, Robert Owen, this English utopian socialist, stood atop his colony in New Harmony, Indiana. This was like one of the first communist socialist communes in the United States, and he delivered what he called his Declaration of Mental Independence. This actually happened. People don't know about this. People should probably learn about this in their schools. But he stood there, and he proclaimed at that point, he declared war on what he called the Trinity, the most monstrous evils ever combined to inflict mental and physical evil upon the human race. And what was this trinity of monstrous evils? It was the Hydra, as he called it, the three-headed Hydra of private property, irrational systems of religion, and marriage. So 1826, you already had these radical socialists. Even 20-some years before Marx and Engels emerged in Europe at the time, declaring war on religion, private property, and marriage. So this push to redefine the family and marriage and take down God's plan for marriage and the family, this has been going on literally in American soil for a couple centuries. This is a very important history that people just don't know about.
Wow, Paul, there is a lot of bugged out eyes in the studio over here right now. It's unbelievable. All right, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Paul Kengor just after the break. Stay tuned. It's 46 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. Forty-eight minutes after the hour, talking to Dr. Paul Kengor, Center for Vision and Values. Paul, the MIT Press is publishing Communism for Kids book, talking about ways to teach the tenets of Karl Marx with fairy tales. How charming.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine fairy tales for this one. I mean, these... really, the fairy tales ought to be this kind of monstrous dragon that's devouring people. Right? I mean, that would be appropriate. But instead here, I think, Karl Marx is going to be dressed up as a fairy princess. Or maybe, the bullfrog gets kissed and a beautiful Karl Marx appears, there's nothing fairy tale-ish about an ideology that's responsible for the deaths of, easily 100 million people in the last century, which is double the combined death tolls of World War I and World War II.
Well, in the book, it says at the end, Communism for Kids ends with the message that class warfare could lead to a better world.
Wow.
Wow,
yeah,
is
that's
right.
Really amazing. That's really horrifying. Lenin preached hatred, and these guys thrived on class warfare. And really, 100 million people dead. The Nazis annihilated people based on ethnicity, right? It was racial hatred. The communists killed people based on class. It was class hatred. So, does it make it any better to kill somebody because they're rich rather than kill somebody because they're Jewish? I mean, either way, you're killing people. You're violating the obvious inherent dignity, sanctity of every human being made in the image of God. Killing people is wrong.
Right.
So, this should be a very simple to explain Communism for Kids. I could do it in about a paragraph. but that book, and people listening might be thinking, maybe it's a negative book. No. This is a positive book, and one of the authors is a cultural Marxist, which is exactly the type of Marxists that we're talking about, Marxists who don't want to just attack based on class and economics, but want to attack based on sexuality, gender, family, marriage, and these key cultural issues.
Well, I just think it's kind of poetic that after you said that, the bells of the clock tower rang.
I know. In my little personal office here, that's for whom the bell tolls.
Yes, exactly. Now, you've got a new book coming out. Coming out just around the corner, May 1st, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Give us a little preview.
Well, thanks. Thanks for mentioning it. Yeah, it comes out May 1st, and a number of different anniversaries, but this is the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, when all of this started, and May 13th will be the anniversary of the shooting of Pope John Paul II in St. Peter's Square by Mehmet Ali Asha, who, as I lay out very carefully in the book, Bill, he was hired by the Soviets to kill the Pope, to shoot the leader of the Roman Catholic Church. I lay that out very carefully. And that occurred just 6 weeks after the shooting of Ronald Reagan in Washington, D.C., and Reagan and John Paul II, who from the outset wanted to work together to defeat atheistic Soviet communism, they came together a year after those shootings, June 1982, in Rome. And here you had this Protestant president and this obviously Catholic pope. And they came together, they met alone in the Vatican Library for 50 minutes, they prayed together. And they shared with one another their mutual conviction that they believed that God had spared their lives for the purpose of taking on and defeating atheistic Soviet communism. And from that day on in Rome, they committed themselves and their staffs to that objective, to defeat Soviet communism, which they pulled off together by the end of the 1980s. It's really a very touching And I think really an amazing story.
Now we're all mouthing the words "wow" in the studio.
Mm. It's a wow story. It's a great story. And among the things that I report in there, and this is we've actually embargoed this. I'm not supposed to talk about it publicly until May 1st. But
okay.
But there is an amazing story about what the Reagan team learned about the Soviet role in the shooting of John Paul II, which they kept secret and to this day has been amazingly kept secret, but which I'm going to be releasing in this book.
Oh, now you've got me real interested. And you've got a nice endorsement. It says, "No Reagan biographer or scholar knows Ronald Reagan and conservatism like Paul Kengor." And that's from Michael Reagan.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The Reagan child who I like to say Michael Reagan is the only adopted child of Ronald Reagan, but he is the most thoroughly Reagan of all Reagan's children. I mean, he is kind of like the of all the Reagan children, he's the closest to his father ideologically. So with him saying that about me, but I should add, the closest to his father spiritually as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And and Ronald Reagan once pulled Michael aside on Easter weekend after hearing Patty and Ron kind of prattle on about their atheism and their Hinduism and their Buddhism and their spiritualism and their whateverism. And he pulled Michael aside and he said, "Boy, I really wish that Ron and Patty were Christians like me and you."
Wow.
They really had a bond over that.
I did not know that the Pope and the President were such pals.
They were. They were very close. And Ronald Reagan actually referred to John Paul II as his best friend. And I asked Nancy Reagan about that. I asked Mike Reagan, a number of people about it. And really, Bill, they weren't best friends in the sense of, the Pope would call up Reagan on, Christmas 1995 and say, "Hey, how are the kids? You want to go fishing? You want to come over and let's catch a ball game?"
Right. Can you help me move the sofa down to the basement?
Right.
That's never going to happen.
Right. It wasn't anything like that. But they did meet together five times, including after the presidency in 1990 at Castel Gandolfo in Rome, the Pope's private residence. That's a meeting that no one knows about. But they, I think what Ronald Reagan meant by that is that when it came to this battle against the evil empire, as Reagan called it, and as John Paul II likewise saw it, really no one was more of his best friend than Pope John Paul II in that effort to defeat Soviet communism.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I don't know if this is a myth or not or true, but when Reagan was shot, he was taken to the hospital, and I think one of the nurses or doctors said, Mr. President, are you allergic to anything? And he said, well, bullets.
He might well have. He joked with them.
Yeah.
He said, "I hope you're all Republicans."
I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny. He wrote in his diary after this too, Bill. And you'll appreciate this. I mean, he was such a jokester. He wrote, "It was unbelievably painful. Getting shot hurts."
He wrote
in his diary, "Getting shot hurts."
Yeah. Paul. So.
Go ahead.
Oh, just after the release of this book, May 1st, can you come back on shortly thereafter and continue the conversation?
I'd be happy to do a full hour if you wanted, and even take phone calls if you.
That would be terrific. We probably couldn't do a full hour, but we could take phone calls. So we'll set it up, and we'll have you back on soon.
Okay.
All right. Thanks
so much, Bill.
Yep.
All right. Take care.
Yep. It's 57 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be right back to wrap things up this morning.